One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com. Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to... As 30-year-old Gunter Padola sat in the dock of the Old Bailey, the ghost of a cut still lingering above his left eye, he was not the only man on trial in the murder of Detective Sergeant Raymond Purdy. As so was the testimony of his partner, D.S. John Sanford, and the recollections of the 8 CID officers who stormed Room 15, and it is said, caused the culprit's amnesia, whether by accident or brutality. Justice Davies forewarned the jury,
"You will have to ask yourselves, do you believe Detective Sergeant John Sanford's evidence and regard him as honest, accurate, and reliable?"
As with no independent witnesses to either the culprit's assault or the officer's murder, testimony was based on an amnesiac with a death sentence hanging over his head, and 8 celebrated CID officers, keen to protect their careers, their colleagues, their reputations, and the memory of an officer shot down in the line of duty. But was Gunter's amnesia an excuse, an accident, or police brutality? Thursday the 16th of July 1959, on the third floor of the Claremont House Hotel at 95 Queensgate, all 8 CID officers would clarify.
"At 3:45 p.m., we took a position facing the door of Room 15.
A small room, barely big enough for one man, comprising a bed, a chair, a wardrobe, and no exits except for that door. Inside, as he washed, unaware that he was cornered, Gunter was believed to be armed and deadly. With the hotel's residents moved somewhere safe, this incident can only be based on the testimony of those 8 CID officers standing outside of Room 15. Superintendent Hislop, Chief Inspector Acott, Inspector Vibart, DS's Chambers and Davies, DC's Morrissey and Vaughan, PC Collett, and his police dog, Flame. But when you examine the evidence, some of the details don't make sense. As expected, their statements describe a by-the-book operation by unflustered professionals in the midst of extraordinary circumstances. Being tasked to apprehend a suspect, to preserve evidence, and to protect the lives of the public themselves, and the culprit who was yet to be proven guilty. There was no confusion of orders, no impatience to get it done, and interestingly, no frustration or anger. And yet, this wasn't an ordinary blackmailer. This was the killer of their friend, who just 48 hours earlier had been gunned down in cold blood. Some saw him die, some were at his autopsy, and some would comfort his weeping widow and crying kids. In a callous murder which had caused so much outrage that a fund was set up, and many people cited this case as a reason not to abolish the death penalty. They were professionals, but they were also human, whose judgment can be clouded by anger when standing before the room of the man who had murdered their pal, whose body lay on a cold mortuary slab. In court, they would testify,
"We were issued with revolvers and truncheons."
Which made sense, as the unseen occupant of room 15 was an armed suspect fleeing a policeman's brutal murder. And yet they would all clarify,
"But neither were used or drawn."
Which seems odd, given the threat to their safety. As their training decreed, it was said that D.I. Vibart announced their presence by hollering, "Police, open up!"
Open up!
Which they had to, being eight officers in plain dark suits. And yet, in their statements, none of the residents three floors below would report hearing the officer holler, "Police, open up!" Or even his name, Gunter Badola, or any of his aliases, to make him aware that it was him they were after. Was this why Gunter didn't reply? Was he afraid? Or did he not know it was the police? But that still leaves unanswered questions. With all of the officers stating the door was shut, why did they choose to open it by force, when they could have unlocked it with the hotel's master key? The door was strong, so having given it a good run-up, when D.I. Vibart barged it with all of his weight, the lock didn't break and the jamb didn't splinter. It held firm and it didn't budge. But when D.S. Chambers was requested to break it down, with all of the officers confirming that they heard a voice inside and the faint metal click of the door lock, why did he barge the door? D.S. Chambers described it as a terrific crash, as the door smashed open. But again, the wood didn't splinter and the lock didn't snap, as Gunter had already opened it. The police's lawyers would claim that his amnesia, if it was real, occurred when his head was hit on the door as the officers stormed in, as confirmed by
his left eye swelling and the cut above it bleeding.
But with Gunter seen not being bent forward as the police barged in, Dr. Larkin confirmed
that slight concussion could not account for his amnesia, and the door was an unlikely cause.
D.S. Chambers, who forced the door, would state,
"Padola staggered backwards. He fell over a chair and finished up lying face up on the floor with his head in the fireplace,"
as the other officers followed him in. It was a tiny room for eight officers, a police dog and a suspect. And yet, the crime scene photos show no sign of a disturbance, nothing broken, and even a small waste paper bin beside the fireplace where the struggle took place being upright. As were the curtains, the wardrobe, the chair, and the bed. D.S. Chambers stated,
"I fell on him with my full force. I held his arms down forcefully to stop him using a weapon."
And yet it wasn't until later that they found the gun, not in that room, but hidden in the attic. So in truth, Gunter was unarmed. Dressed only in a vest and a pair of trousers, with the full 17-stone bulk of D.S. Chambers on top of this 12-stone weakling,
with Padola on his back, struggling violently, and continuing to resist arrest for about 3 to 4 minutes.
Two more officers fell on top of him
to assist in restraining the prisoner.
Held with his hands behind his back, his feet held together, and several burly coppers, weighing at least 30 stone, forcing down on top of him. Dr. Ashby told the court,
"I do not know whether he lost consciousness from the head injury, a hysterical stupor, or such a weight upon his chest."
But all agreed. Padola went limp. D.S. Chambers said,
"He stopped struggling. I drew DCI ACOT's attention to this and got off him, saying, 'I think he's been knocked out. He's had a bang over the eye.'
In total,
he was unconscious for not more than a few minutes.
Although having suffered a head injury, shock, and suffocation, with possible oxygen starvation, no one called for an ambulance. No one checked his pulse or breathing. And he would be denied professional medical attention for at least the next hour. Some may say, what happened next shows the police's professionalism. As just 48 hours after their colleague's killing, they cared for his killer's culprit. Whereas others may simply call it a whitewash. DCI ACOT ordered the bed to be stripped and searched for weapons, which was why blood was found on the mattress.
We put Padola on the bed, a blanket around his shoulders and a pillow behind his back.
Of course, these sheets could have been used to muffle the sounds and to aid suffocation, but that's just conjecture.
D.I. Vibart, D.C. Morrissey and myself,
D.S. Chambers,
gave him first aid. We bathed the cut over his eye, took him to the wash basin, and gave him a good sluice around the back of his head and neck.
He couldn't do it himself, as he was handcuffed with his hands behind his back. But was he being washed or waterboarded? As being a lone suspect in a room full of officers and no other eyewitnesses, who would know any different? It was then that Gunter began to suffer a slew of unusual, intermittent symptoms.
Padola began to shake violently, like he was having a seizure.
Only again, no one called for a doctor. Instead, blaming it on shock or a head injury, they kept him warm until it ceased. At 4:15 p.m., a full 30 minutes after room 15 was forcibly entered, although he had trouble standing up, Gunter was escorted from the Claremont House Hotel and into a police car, aided by two officers. His movements were slow and unsteady. At no time did he speak or make a sound or statement. And keen to protect his identity, or maybe to disguise his wounds,
I had his head covered with a coat.
With the killer of Detective Sergeant Purdy caught, this photo was front page news. And yet he hadn't been cautioned, charged, or arrested. Recollection and written record are very different things, as would be proved by the damning testimony of Ronald Gray, that in post-war Berlin, Gunter Padola had blackmailed a grieving widow. It was the evidence the prosecution needed, but it was littered with problems. As with every statement destroyed, they couldn't confirm if his confession had been acquired under duress, coercion, or assault. The storming of Room 15 had some similarities, as although the officers were issued with notebooks for the purpose of recording the details to ensure a thorough record, they had failed to take accurate notes of the events. And even though eyewitnesses gave their statements that day, many officers didn't submit theirs for at least a week, by which time their accounts were suspiciously similar in style and wording. Which takes us back to the events prior to the murder of Detective Sergeant Raymond Purdy. On Monday the 13th of July 1959, at 3:40 p.m, DS's Sanford and Purdy approached a phone booth in South Kensington Station to apprehend a blackmailer known as Mr. Fisher, an alias of Gunter Padola. But with Purdy dead, and Padola an amnesiac, of that moment, all we have is the testimony of DS Sanford, who the judge would ask the jury, "Do you believe his evidence and regard him as honest, accurate, and reliable?" If we re-examine those moments through the eyes of Gunter Padola, they appear very different. As how did he know that they were the police? Being cornered, it is said that DS Purdy declared,
"We are police officers. Who are you and what are you up to?"
But what if he didn't? Or what if Gunter didn't believe them? Gunter was a German, a much maligned nationality in post-war Britain, who as a fervent Nazi had fled Canada owing to his criminality, had possibly been brutalized by British intelligence officers in Berlin, and a blackmailer who was operating under another criminal gang's turf. So how did he know? As being dressed in dark suits so they could blend in, all he had was the word of these plain-clothed officers. Again, DS Sanford's notebook was incomplete, and his statement was taken a week later, having adopted CID's lazy habit in which they would finesse and fudge any details over a cuppa with their colleagues. It is stated that DS Purdy said,
"We are taking you to Chelsea Police Station on suspicion of demanding money with menaces from Mrs. Schiffman."
At which he was cautioned, but made no reply. But why? At this point, he wasn't arrested or charged. He wasn't handcuffed or searched. So did this spook him? And as he was escorted by two men in dark suits to their car, spotting that it wasn't a marked police car, but a black Wolseley saloon, did this fill him with dread? Is this why he ran? And being cornered in the hallway of 105 Onslow Square, is this why he made the fateful decision to shoot his way out? ...1959 was a bad year for the police, especially in Britain and unequivocally in London. So bad were the beatings
of blacks, old lacks, and the poor by officers in private rooms with fists, truncheons, straps and boots,
that in May 1959, the National Council for Civil Liberties asked for a public inquiry. As just three examples of police brutality by London officers in 1959, a Cypriot in Soho testified that two officers in the presence of an inspector had beaten him black and blue with a stick. The officers were not charged. In August, at Chelsea Police Station, a black stoker, was kicked and strangled in the cells. No charges were brought. And an RAF officer was beaten for 2 hours with a ruler, only for the officers to state,
"He got violent and slipped when we chased him."
The police in the 1950s had become too powerful and too corrupt. Sir Robert Mark, the Met Police's commissioner, would openly state,
"The CID were the most routinely corrupt organisation in London,
with many
being bent for the job.
By taking bribes, dealing drugs, turning a blind eye for profit, fitting up suspects, and closing ranks when their crimes were queried." By the late 1970s, Operation Countryman investigated hundreds of City of London police officers who had facilitated a series of armed robberies, with one cop stating,
"All the blokes on the robbery squad had a drink on it,"
meaning taking a bribe,
which went right to the top.
Only when he went to court, every officer was acquitted, as no one dared to speak. So common was this corruption that Sir Paul Condon, the head of the Met in the 1990s, coined the phrase
"noble cause corruption."
As with cops too keen to nail the accused without enough proof, it was said,
"At every station, there would be guys who excelled as scriptwriters. And the officers would leave their notebooks blank until the scriptwriter provided everyone with a carbon copy of the statement."
At 4:30 p.m, at the rear of Chelsea Police Station, Gunter ascended the steps to the charge room. Chief Inspector Haxby recalled,
"He was taken to the DI's office for 2 minutes until the charge room was cleared. His left eye was swelling. He had a small cut over that eye, and he was in a shocked condition."
Although lightly dressed in vest and trousers, with no shoes or socks,
as he kept fainting, all the doors were opened and the fans switched on.
And being deemed unfit to be charged, arrested, or to see a solicitor,
the duty officer phoned the police surgeon while two officers remained outside of his cell.
At 5:10 p.m, 1 hour and 40 minutes after his head injury and possible suffocation, Gunter was assessed by Dr. John Shanahan as dazed, frightened, and exhausted. Moved to cell number one, Gunter was prescribed bed rest and not hospitalization. But as he mentally shut down and his eyes swelled further, physically, he seemed to deteriorate. PCs Hannigan and Hall stated,
"He slept a lot."
Which may seem odd that a wanted cop killer held in an isolated cell in a police station known for its corruption and brutality would take a snooze. But was that symptomatic of his lack of empathy, a resignation to his fate? Or was he slipping into a coma? Chief Inspector Haxby testified,
"At no time did he speak or suffer any interrogation whatsoever.
In fact, according to his guards,
the only time he talked was when he requested to go to the toilet.
Only being unsteady on his feet,
he was assisted by PC Hind and myself to the toilet in the cell, where his trousers and pants were removed and he was placed on the seat."
But oddly, with Inspector Burdett suggesting he had wet himself, the prisoner was stripped of his clothes.
Order! Order! I say to the Honourable Gentleman.
Denied medical attention for 2 hours, hospitalisation for 10, and confined to her cell for 6 hours without a solicitor. His treatment caused such an outcry that it was debated in the House of Commons by Baronet Reginald Paget, a highly respected barrister and Labour MP, to Home Secretary Rab Butler.
I asked the Home Secretary, what happened to Gunter Podola during the 6 hours at Chelsea Police Station, which necessitated his removal to a hospital on a stretcher? My concern is not whether he was charged, but on those officers who beat him unconscious.
To which Mr. Butler retorted,
Mr. Paget has no right to say that Podola was beaten unconscious. He has no proof of that whatsoever.
As according to the police, he was simply resting, and his hospitalisation was owing to mental exhaustion. Mr. Paget would fight on.
With respect, the people should be safe in British police stations. And that the idea that either vengeance or beatings occur in British police stations is utterly unacceptable.
At 12:50 a.m. on Friday the 17th of July 1959, Gunter was admitted to St. Stephen's Hospital. According to Dr. Latham, whose notes, along with his colleagues, were exceptional, and as independent witnesses would provide the backbone of the medical testimony, he would state of his physical wounds,
he had a half-inch laceration over his left eyebrow, a half-inch bruise over his left forehead, a slight swelling to the left jaw, minimal bruising to the upper arm and blood in the nostrils,
but no evidence of skull fractures. Moved to Ward B5, Dr. Ashton would state,
it is difficult to assess this patient because he is completely uncommunicative. And because of his head injury, it has obscured his personality.
That day, Dr. Philip Harvey, the consulting physician at St. Stephen's, sent a letter to the police reporting,
Mr. Podola is suffering from the after effects of a concussion and a cerebral contusion,
a bleeding on the surface of the brain.
I anticipate the need for a further 2 or 3 days here, as his recovery will be slow.
And it was. Guarded by 3 shifts of 2 officers, 24 hours a day, over the next 4 days, whilst chained to the bed, Gunter needed help from the nurses and the officers to do even the simplest of things. To walk, to stand, and to sit. He had difficulty raising a spoon of food, smoking a cigarette. And again, this 30-year-old man needed 2 adults to remove his pants and to sit him on a toilet like a baby. Repeating the same basic phrase to the doctor,
what happened to me?
Gunter had no memory of his injuries, the assault, or the murder. He would have no memory of his 4 days in hospital, or even of the life he had lived up till that moment, except for a few fragments which flashed before his mind. When asked, he didn't even know his own name. Dr. Harvey confirmed,
it was clear that severe retrograde amnesia was present,
where you can't recall memories formed before the incident that caused the amnesia, but that
he is fit to be interviewed and to understand the nature of the charge, but he is not able at this moment to act in a testamentary capacity regarding the events leading up to his admission because of the presence of retrograde amnesia.
His bruises and cuts would heal. But so painfully slow was his mental recovery that even 8 weeks later, when Gunter stood trial at the Old Bailey for the murder of D.S. Purdy, although 9 days of the 11-day trial was solely to decide if he was fit to stand or give evidence, he could recall nothing. on Monday the 20th of July, 4 days after the incident, Mr. Williams, Gunter's court-appointed solicitor, was permitted to speak to his client. But so damaged was his memory that when he was handed a document to sign, he had no idea what it meant, and his solicitor had to spell his name for him. At 2:50 p.m, back at Chelsea police station, and this time with his solicitor present, Gunter was formally charged by Superintendent Hislop for the murder of D.S. Purdy. He was cautioned, but made no reply, before being committed to criminal trial following a hearing at West London Magistrates Court. Tried at the Old Bailey for a crime he couldn't recall, the police would deny any accusations of brutality, statement doctoring, or a cover-up. Their defence was that, laughable as it may seem, that Gunter's state of amnesia was merely a convenient ploy to escape a death sentence at the hangman's noose. Gunter was unable to testify against these 8 celebrated CID officers, who were all keen to protect their careers, their colleagues, their reputations, and the memory of a police officer killed in the line of duty. It was a case which Justice Edmund Davies would state was reliant on whether the jury believed them and could or should regard D.S. Sandford and his colleagues as honest, accurate, and reliable. Recollection and written record are 2 very different things. But if the police's statements were an accurate report of the events, as they would vehemently claim, that left the jury with an odd quandary. If the police were telling the truth, then Gunter Badola was lying. Part 3 of 3 of Shattered Memory continues next week.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Too bad. Whoa. Taking your hat off. There we go. Cor-lummy. There we go, folks. That was part 2. Oh, I'm doing all this out of sequence at the moment. Oh, so welcome to Extra Mile, unscripted, unedited bit. Blah, 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 blah. Do some extra stuff. Have a chat. Maybe have a cup of tea. I'm not going to have a cup of tea. Not going to have a cake because I'm still on my diet. Eva's got me on a strict diet. I'm eating a carrot. Carrot and vegetables every 2 hours throughout the day to keep my metabolism good and make sure that I don't put on weight. I think she wants me nice and skinny, because then she can go, oh, now you're too skinny, and then she can fat me up. She loves doing that. And then she every hour she comes by and she slaps my ass and goes, that ass isn't fat enough, fat boy. Or she stands in front of me and then she wobbles me and she watches my tits go up and down, and she enjoys that. Oh, if it keeps her happy. So, yes, so just recording this, everything's out of sequence at the moment for me, obviously, because having a good couple of days, even though I still can't see out my left eye, and my right eye is okay, because I'm not in any pain at the moment. I've got the painkillers at the right level, hence I'm able to sleep, so I'm sounding all right. I'm recording all of the narration for parts 1, 2, and 3 back to back, and then I can edit the rest afterwards, which is good. It got to a point with my eye when I was like thinking, shit, do I do Eliza Crease and the Honeymoon from Hell? Is that the last episode? And then I had some backup daily entries I could put out, and then I was like, shit, what am I going to do if I can't write anymore? But I think my eye seems to be doing okay. I think I'll be injured for quite a while, but as long as I'm not in any pain, that should be all right. What else is going on? I'm not going to have a tea. I'm all right at the moment. I'm going to go to the coffee shop that does a nice chamomile tea in a bit, but I'm going to have, there we go, Diet Coke. Chemicals. Oh, yummy. Chemicals. So that's all good. Just moved my boat a tiny bit. I can't move it too far because I can't see. But I moved it about 100 feet because just opposite me, or just down from opposite me, was two little dogs who would always stand on the boat and bark all day. And then just further up was another dog, and they would bark back and forth. And then in the middle, even worse, someone's got a cockerel. Fucking cockerel. And you think, oh, that's nice, the cockerel can wake you up when it's dawn. But as we know, cockerels are little bastards, aren't they? And they don't, it literally all day, every hour, it goes cock-a-doodle-loo, cock-a-doodle-loo, cock-a-doodle-loo. And even worse, it keeps doing it throughout the night. So I'm a light sleeper, and sometimes I'll wake up and I'll hear cock-a-doodle-loo at 2 a.m. and you just go, you little shit. Oh, I'm not into animal cruelty, but for that one, I would take pleasure in cutting his head off and sticking him in the oven and serving him with some nice potatoes. And I would enjoy every single mouthful of that little mouthy bastard. And then I would shit him out. Yeah. So what else is going on? What else is going on? I went to a mate's wedding recently. That was really nice. All went really well. I had one job to do. Because they did the reception in their parents' house. They go, why? Because it's a second wedding, so they didn't want a big one. They wanted to keep it low key and just all the key people. So they're like, Mike, we got a good job for you. Can you make sure, because the fridge wasn't working well? So can you fill up the bath with ice during the day? It was a hot day. It was like 29 degrees. Can you fill up the bath with ice? Fill it full of beers and all that, and so people can have cold drinks all night. So I was like, right, I'm going to do that job properly. I filled it up with 65 kilos of ice, which I got from a supermarket about half a mile away. So I was shuttling back and forth from the supermarket to there. The lady, I always went to the same lady at the till, and she knew exactly what I was doing. And she's like, how's it going? Is it all going well? Yes. It was so good. The bath was full of beers. I got one side, I split it into different beers, different kinds of wines, different things like Prosecco and stuff like that, and soft drinks for people like that, and filled it full of ice. And it was so good. It was like, one time during the start of the wedding, the reception, I was like, where is everyone? And I realised there was just a crowd of people in the bathroom staring at my bath of ice. So there we go. If you go onto social media, you will see it. I think it was at the start of June. My bath of ice. There you go. Yeah, although it was so much ice that I broke my bag. I had to go into Sports Direct where I got the bag from and say, oh, it broke. I don't know how it broke. Both straps snapped. It snapped because of all the ice I was carrying in a heat wave. But there we go. That's that. What else is going on? I am, because of my punctured eye, really annoying. I was meant to be going to see my sister in America next week, but I don't know whether I can do it because I don't know whether I've waiting to see from my eye specialist whether I can be allowed to go on a flight because I have, because of a punctured eye, my eye has different pressures in the eye. So I don't know whether, Even though an aircraft is pressurised, I need to get his sign-off, which is really annoying because I spent a grand and a half to fly out there. Now I might not be able to go there. Really annoying. Anyway, we'll see how it goes. It'd be nice to go there. Thank you this week to two Patreon subscribers. So thank you to Olivia Totten and Jim Balfour. So thank you, Olivia and Jim. Thank you so much for becoming Patreon subscribers. Obviously, you get goodies in the post, some of which I'll be sending off today. Obviously, that's not today when you hear this. This is in the past. In the past. So thank you for that. And obviously, with this, you get lots of crime scene photos and things like that, which are on the Patreon account, hidden away only on Patreon. So thank you so much for supporting the show. It's very much appreciated. Let's do some quiz questions. 10 quiz questions. And we'll do the answers to them very shortly. So here we go. Question number one. What was the name of the judge in the Old Bailey trial? Question number two. How many people were in room 15 when the police stormed in? Question number three. What weight was D.S. Chambers who broke down the door? Question number four. What alias was Gunter using when he was apprehended by the police at the tube station? Burpees. Question number five. In May 1959, who asked for a public inquiry into police beatings? Question number six. How did Sir Paul Condon, the Met Police Commissioner, describe corruption in the police force in the 1990s? Question number seven. What was Gunter wearing when he was arrested? Question number eight. What was Gunter doing when the police broke down the door? Question number nine, name the two officers who guarded his cell in Chelsea Police Station. Good luck if you got that one, because there's a lot of names in this episode. And question number 10, why did the police say he was removed to hospital? So, let's dive. This whole episode, these three parts, is all about recollections, and not only is this all about amnesia, we'll get into more about that next week as well, about Gunter's amnesia, but when I was going through the police files on this, I thought actually this is a really interesting case, because what we're actually dealing with here is recollection and statements. And if you go back to the Soho Strangler and you see some of the support episodes I did with that, a lot of it is about how people remember things and how they don't remember things, and how people get easily confused. And, you know, even if you take a statement immediately, you could get a percentage right. But then if say with the CID, they did their statements a week later and it is said that they did their statements together, which you're not meant to do. You get different recollections for people. So it's fascinating when you go through it with the CID officers. I've kind of referenced it in here, but when you read their statements, it's almost like, as mentioned in this episode, when it was said that in some police stations they would have, inverted commas, script editors who would sit down and would work out the statement first, then all the officers would get the statement and they'd read it, and some of them would almost do it like a cut and paste job. Others would add their own flourishes to it, but pretty much everything was exactly as it was. And that's really what you get here. So with these officers all doing their statements a week later, of course everything's going to be a bit messy. So that seemed to be their way. It wasn't really there seemed to be a real arrogance amongst them as like, oh, we won't do our statements now. We'll do it in a week when we can be bothered, which is not really how you should run an investigation. So also that kind of breaks down the case prior to the murder. So you've got the murder itself, and then you've got the apprehension of Gunter by the two detectives. So D.S. Sanford and D.S. Purdy. Now, given the fact that D.S. Purdy is dead, therefore he didn't put any notes in his notebook, and he didn't do a witness statement because he was dead. Because Gunter was diagnosed with amnesia and he can't remember anything from the Monday when he left the hospital prior to that, which includes his assault in room 15, I put that in air quotes, and the murder itself. because there's no other people there, the only real witness that we actually have there is Mrs. Malvina Jones Schiffman, who D.S. Purdy said, Mrs. Schiffman, this is Sergeant Purdy, please remember my name. And then he put down the phone. That's all she remembers. And she stated that in her reports. So that's fine. But she didn't hear anything else after that moment because the phone was put down. So we don't have any corroborative witnesses for that. There's no witnesses to the arrest inside South Kensington Tube Station. So you kind of have the moment where, if you think about it, the officers are turning up. They're not in police uniforms. You've got Gunter, who's kind of has a fear of authority coming from kind of war-torn Berlin. They're not in uniforms at all. They're plain clothed. They say, "We are police officers. Who are you? What are you up to?" This is the kind of thing. Do they show their badges? It would be something that they do, but did they do that? Let's not forget that this is Chelsea CID. They're kind of a force unto their own. They have their own kind of rules that they live by. So it could be that maybe they didn't do that. Maybe he didn't believe they were policemen. Maybe he believed that they were criminals and he was working on their turf. So it's when you start boiling a lot of stuff down, it's hard to kind of... you can kind of see why he would run, why he would panic. Although, as we've seen with the blackmail charge from from Berlin, the one that we'll keep going back to in this series, because it's kind of quite important that you can kind of see what he was doing 10 years earlier. You can see that he is prone to fleeing. He's a small-time criminal, prone to fleeing, not adverse to kind of suggesting that he may kill someone if he needs to escape, or, doing what he needs to do. John Sanford said the number of the call box was Knightsbridge 2355. It was the accused in the phone box. He had a phone in his left hand and in his right hand he was fingering the pages of a notebook. He was deliberately fingering the pages of the notebook. I didn't explain this in the first episode because it's kind of unimportant, but he was pretending that this was all the evidence that he'd got of Malvina Jones Schiffman, i.e. Vern O'Hara, saying, "Oh yeah, I've got all these documents about you and what you're up to with your secret love life." It wasn't. It was his shitty little notebook, of which he'd scrawled in his notes, which we heard about last week and this week. He said, "Purdy and I opened the door of the telephone kiosk. Sergeant Purdy took the telephone out of the man's hand and with his other hand picked up the notebook. Purdy spoke into the phone in the presence and hearing of the accused and said, 'Mrs. Schiffman, this is Sergeant Purdy, remember my name.' That's kind of fateful, really, isn't it? He then put down the phone. The prisoner had edged backwards out of the kiosk and I caught hold of him. After Purdy had put down the receiver, he asked the prisoner, 'We are police officers, who are you and what are you up to?' The prisoner made no reply." This seems to be something that Gunter does a lot, that he doesn't reply to things. You'll see that in the Berlin statement as well. Sergeant Purdy said, "We are going to take you to Chelsea Police Station on suspicion of demanding money with a menace from Mrs. Schiffman." He was cautioned but made no reply. Now, as mentioned in the episode, this is kind of the thing when you look at it. They're in plain clothes. Did they show their ID? They said they were policemen, but how could he prove it? They didn't handcuff him. They didn't arrest him. So obviously at that point, that's kind of at their discretion. Do you know, he's really just a suspect at that moment. All they've really got, when you think about it, is a man who's on the phone. And it's not like they're on immediate communication with the telephone exchange and going, yeah, he's still on the phone now. It's like 2 minutes ago when they were on the phone, the kiosk, the exchange people said, "Yeah, he's on this phone right now." 2 minutes later, they sped there. They ran. It could be someone else. It could be someone entirely different. So they don't know it's Gunter Padola. They don't know the name Gunter Padola. They don't know what the man looks like. All they know is that he's on the phone to Mrs. Schiffman, but it could be someone else. It could be someone else who just happened to be calling her. So they've got to be really careful by this point. And don't forget, they've only got a limited amount of time to question him. So they've got to make sure they've got everything ready. But they can detain him, which is what they're doing. Sergeant Sanford said we went up the stairs and into Sydney Place. Sydney Place is kind of, you've got to cross over a slightly main road, and it's over heading towards Onslow Square. We got to the police station and the man ran across the road. Now think about it, this is an unmarked car, they're not in a uniform, they may not have shown their ID, he may have just panicked. Sergeant Sanford said we chased after him, but as Sergeant Purdy reached the centre of the road he fell heavily. By this time the man had turned right into Onslow Square, and after dodging passing cars I continued to run after him. As I continued to chase him along the north pavement of Onslow Square in a westerly direction, I saw a man walking east towards the man I was chasing, and I shouted out as loud as I could, "Police, stop that man." This must have been heard by the man as I was chasing. However, the man to whom I shouted took no notice. People out there helping the police do their job. Well done. The man just went about his daily life. The man took no notice. As I continued running after the man, Sergeant Purdy drew level with me on a taxi. I jumped on the running board. The running board is back in with the old taxis. They used to have on the side of the car. They had kind of a probably about 8-10 inches. It's just like a board that you could kind of put your foot on before you get into the car. But some police, if they needed to get a lift somewhere, they would jump on the running board and get driven off. I jumped on the running board on the driver's side and we followed the man, who was seen to run into the hallway of 105 Onslow Square. Which is kind of weird when you look at it. If you look at the crime scene photos, it's 105 Onslow Square. He goes in and it's a very big, empty kind of hallway. It's very wide and there's a couple of columns in there. But, I mean, he could have ran upstairs. He could have ran upstairs and hid, but, you know, maybe made his way to the roof. But if he's thinking about it, that probably most of the doors would have been locked because these were private entrances. He could have waited for the lift, but the lift would have taken ages. He's a bit stuck, really. He's got nowhere to go. So effectively, he's cornered. It's kind of silly when he's in there. The police run in and he's hiding behind a pillar. And it's just absolutely ridiculous. But it's interesting. He doesn't come across as threatening. I think because he's very boyish and because he's, you know, he's wearing slightly fancy clothes and green sunglasses, apparently. They don't really take him as a threat. Do you know, he doesn't seem to threaten them. He doesn't call them bad names. He doesn't resist arrest. Do you know, he runs away from them. But when he's cornered, DS Purdy goes, "Right, you there, I'm not having your games anymore. Get on that windowsill." And he does. He sits on the windowsill with his hands on his legs. So he's not really doing anything. So it's kind of unfortunate at that point that they didn't make the decision to search him. They could have done, but they didn't. And we kind of don't really know why at that point. Maybe it was just a mistake on their behalf. Maybe they just didn't see him as a threat at all. But as with D.S. Sanford, he would state, "I noticed nothing peculiar about him. He was perfectly ordinary, other than he was a sullen type of attitude." And that's kind of what he gives off. He said, Sergeant Purdy then said, "Sit in that windowsill and behave yourself." The men then sat on the windowsill just behind the man then sat on the windowsill, helping himself up by putting his hands on the sill either side of his body. So that's why we know that he's definitely there, because his palm prints were there. He also had his palm prints in the phone box as well. And unfortunately, as we've already mentioned in this episode, in the prior episode, this was when Sergeant Purdy was shot. Happened really quickly, very close. I think it was about 3 inches from his 3 to 4 inches away, a single shot to the heart. He fell to the ground gasping, "Ah." I haven't put that in the episode because I don't like doing that. Ah. The shot was heard by Mrs. Hawksworth, who was making tea on the ground floor, as well as David Bruce, a jobber for the stock exchange. Unfortunately, because no one was there, except those officers, nobody actually saw the shot. So DS Purdy saw it, but he obviously died. Gunter saw it, but he would have had amnesia of that whole incident, and then he fled. So the only person was D.S. Sanford who would have seen it, and that's whose recollection we're basing this on. So that's the whole point of this, these episodes is you've got one man who's got amnesia, another man who's the only eyewitness to the murder, and we have to decide, is he accurate? Is he telling the truth? But we're in an era of police corruption. D.S. Sanford would state, the man ran between the open hall door and Sergeant Purdy. He turned left out of the hall, down the entrance steps, turned right onto the right at the foot of the steps. I ran over to Sergeant Purdy and then out into the street. I continued to follow the man who turned right into Cranley Place, but realizing I couldn't keep up with him as he was running so fast and had a lead on me, I returned to the flats. He said Sergeant Purdy was obviously seriously injured. So the police were called. Police doctor turned up very shortly. Mrs. Hawksworth, who was making a cup of tea, she was a nurse, so she provided some assistance right there and then. David John Thomas, who was the medical practitioner for them, arrived at 4:08 p.m. having received a call. He said, in the entrance hall I found a man lying just to the right of the entrance door. There was various police officers with him. I examined him, but he was dead. There were signs of a single bullet hole which had penetrated his chest. I briefly mentioned this in the previous episode. Sergeant Purdy left £775 in his will to his widow, Irene Purdy, and she was granted a £10.10.08 per week police pension. A fund of £3,500 was raised by the mayor of Kensington. There was a real uproar amongst the community that an officer had been killed, an unarmed officer had been killed in the line of duty. And as mentioned as well, this was kind of one of those cases where it had already gone through the House of Commons that they were going to abolish executions. So it wasn't until 1965 that it was kind of all definitely happening. But this had actually started, I think it was 1947 when they started having the conversations. So by this point, they were already getting to the point where they were going, okay, well, this person is convicted and we're going to give him a death sentence, but we will commute it to life. So we're at this point now, but they're still at the point where they're saying, if you shoot, if you murder someone in the pursuance of a theft, i.e. you go to steal something and then you kill someone, that's still a death sentence. Although that would probably be commuted to life at that point now. But killing of a police officer, that was still a death sentence. Obviously, they had a description of Gunter, so they issued that out onto the street. But it was kind of easy to find him, as mentioned in the episode. His fingerprints were everywhere. He wasn't wearing any gloves, so they had fingerprints on the windowsill, consistent with a person assisting himself with hands to get on or off the stone top. They were clear fingerprints as well. Normally, at that point, you only need 5 ridge characteristics to identify a person. They had at least 16 on all of these, and because there were palm prints as well, they were pretty good. Later they would find the pistol, but there were no legible prints on it. Don't forget, most guns are quite oily and prints can be easily removed by kind of just touching it, moving it, putting it into your pocket. They say that only 5% of fingerprints from guns are recoverable. What else have we got? As mentioned, nice and simple. It was easy to track down. 48 hours later, unfortunately, it took that long. When they were at the autopsy, I can't remember the name of the officer. I think it's D.S. Hazlitt or something like that. I've got it written somewhere. Detective Sergeant Holford. They were at the autopsy. They were taking photographs of D.S. Purdy on the slab. They were about to do his autopsy to work out how he died. They knew that he'd been shot, but they just needed to double check anything. And so when they were removing his clothes and they had to check all of the contents inside, they found Gunter's notebook, and it had everything in there. They knew all of his aliases because he put that in there. They also checked his entry in the registry against immigration, which had been filed during his flight from Hamburg. And they also, because of that, they were able to find his prior criminal record in Canada, and they notified the Canadian Mounted Police for his details and a photo, which was sent over to them. They compared his fingerprints to those found at the shooting of Detective Sergeant Purdy, and they proved to be a perfect match. When the photo was received by the Canadian Mounted Police, Detective Sergeant Sanford looked at it, and he confirmed that this person was an exact match. So even before they went into the hotel, they knew exactly that this was exactly the right person that they needed to find. Exactly. I'm going to say exactly one more time. Exactly. So yeah, it was pretty much case closed. I think that was it. And pretty much everything they found in the flat. I was going to do a whole thing about what all the evidence they found, but it was kind of self-explanatory that, you know, they were able to find his clothes. On some of Gunter's clothes was some of Purdy's blood. They were able to find residue from the gun. They had found fingerprints, but not usable fingerprints on the gun as well. They found the clothes which matched what D.S. Sanford said that Gunter was wearing. You know, everything was just perfect. The gun was an exact match. So yeah, not really a lot to kind of say that it wasn't him. But obviously, as mentioned in here, this is a real era of police brutality. So it's not just London, but also Johannesburg, Alabama, Paris, Belfast, various places. So I only gave you a few in there, but there was quite a few. Like May 1959, a 17-year-old youth was beaten up in Newcastle by police officers in an unprovoked attack. Three officers who it said went beyond the scope of their duties. Neither of them were charged for this. As mentioned in the episode, July 1959, a Cypriot was beaten up by two police officers on Berwick Street in Soho. In court, they would state, at the police station, in the presence of an inspector, the officers beat me black and blue with a stick. None of the officers were reprimanded. I think I used most of the ones I needed in that episode. With the RAF officer, this was April 1959, so just before, RAF officer Don Glean Clark stated he was beaten up for 1.5 hours by officers. He would state, I was scientifically beaten up for 2 hours with a ruler, lighted paper was put in front of my face, and smoke blown up my nose and my hair torn out. The officers in charge would state, he slipped when they were chasing him, and that he was violent when we arrested him. So unfortunately, there was a real era of police corruption, especially in the 1940s, which ultimately would lead to the conclusions of the 1960s Royal Commission and the subsequent drafting and debating and the legislation of the 1964 Police Act, which at that point, all the police were kind of their own little fiefdoms, really, across the country. Whereas what they decided to do at that point was, instead of having, like, Chelsea Police Station would have their own rules, and you've got Westminster, not their own rules, but they kind of did the things their own way. Suddenly they would start pushing everything together and going, right, this is a big force here, here's another big force here. And on top of that, you would have the Home Secretary, who's responsible for all of the police forces. So the level of accountability started to change. The first major scandal broke openly in Brighton in 1957, with headlines in the local press reporting the arrival of Scotland Yard detectives to investigate allegations of corruption in the Brighton Borough Police Force. 3 weeks later, Chief Constable, that's pretty high up, Chief Constable John Ridge was arrested along with two officers of Brighton CID and two members of the public and charged with a variety of corrupt practices. So this was kind of where it all started, and it's just the more they dived into it, the more they realized it was quite endemic. Being bent for themselves, i.e. coppers taking bribes from criminals to suppress evidence and skimming off profits from rackets, is usually frowned on, it was said, but being bent for the job is a different matter. In 1972, Sir Robert Mark became Met Commissioner and said the CID were the most routinely corrupt organisation in London, which says a lot. Says a lot. Corrupt organisations in London. There's a lot. It was a supposed golden era for police corruption was in the 1950s. In 1955, the Daily Mail... reported a vast amount of bribery and corruption among officers attached to West End Station. In the 1960s, detectives in London were caught out routinely fitting people up, and there were many scandals, including the closing of ranks and the odd scapegoat being charged, and larger numbers of officers retiring or transferring after an inquiry produced a whitewash. So that seemed to be their way out of it, you know. If you look at Operation Countryman, Operation Countryman was an investigation, late 1970s, early 1980s, into corrupt policing. And basically, the armed robbery squad would basically know all of the criminals. And when they're going to do a bank robbery, they'd go, OK, you pay us so much money, we'll turn a blind eye. We'll tell you where to go and we'll divert police and things like that. And it was a massive, like, there was a lot of people admitting to it, saying this is what's going on. Yeah, do you know, we're all taking a bribe on this one. As he said here, one cop admitted all the blokes on the robbery squad had a drink on it, i.e. meaning they earned money from it, going right to the top. But when it came to trial, all of the police involved were acquitted, as no officer would testify. So they were very much kind of a league of their own. They're almost untouchable. So yeah, pretty bad. Pretty bad. So which is what makes this also an interesting case is the era that we're dealing with, that there is endemic police corruption going on at that point. And so can you really trust the police's statements that they're giving in court, given the fact that there are no independent witnesses? If you think about when they stormed Room 15... They cleared Room 15. They cleared the hotel. So the only person in there was the police and Gunter. And inside the police, inside Chelsea Police Station as well, when they brought Gunter in, they cleared the processing room, where the charge room, and they made sure that there weren't other prisoners in the cells. Now, why did they need to do that? Why did they need it to be nice and private? You know, they admitted that that's why they did it, but why did they need to do that? So there, and Chelsea Police Station, as mentioned, really kind of a corrupt police station, especially in the 1950s. Not there anymore. It's now being turned into posh flats. Yes, you're welcome. Right, let's do some quiz questions. Here's the answers. Question number one: what was the name of the judge on the Old Bailey trial? It was Justice Edmund Davies. All right, but question number two: how many people were in Room 15 when the police stormed in? Well, you can either say 9 or 10. There were 8 CID officers, the suspect Gunter Badola, and if you include the doggy, there were 10. The dog called Flame. There you go. Question number three: what weight was DS Chambers, who broke down the door? He was 17 stone. That's the weight Eva wants me to get up to, so she can see how wobbly I am. Question number four: what alias was Gunter using when he was apprehended at the tube station? It was Mr. Fisher. Question number five: in May 1959, who asked for a public inquiry into police beatings? It was the National Council for Civil Liberties. The National Council for Civil Liberties. Question number six: how did Sir Paul Condon, the Met Police Commissioner, describe corruption in the 1990s? He called it noble cause corruption. Don't forget, Sir Paul Condon was the guy who was running for mayor all those years ago. And it was really embarrassing. Every time he'd be asked a question, because his history is policing, the only answer he could ever give was, "I'll put more police on the streets." And it became a bit of a joke. Like, what will you do about the litter on the streets? "Oh, I'll put more police on the streets." It's like he had nothing else to say. Question number seven: what was Gunter wearing when he was arrested? Vest and pants. Oh, no, sorry. Vest and trousers. Sorry, not vest and pants. Vest and trousers. Question number eight: what was Gunter doing? I'm wearing vest and pants. That's what Eva makes me wear. What was Gunter doing when the police broke into Room 15? He was washing. Question number nine: name the two officers who guarded his cell at Chelsea Police Station. They were PCs Hannigan and Hall, because people like alliteration. And question number 10: why did the police say he was removed to hospital Apparently, he was simply resting and he was hospitalised owing to mental exhaustion. So there we go, folks. That is part two of Shattered Memory. I hope you enjoyed that. Part three, the final part, is next week. So I'm going to go and have another carrot, if Eva will let me. I'm going to finish my Diet Coke. I'm going to go to the little coffee shop up the road, which is very nice, and I'm going to finish. I'm just going to do a rewrite on part three and get ready to record that tomorrow. Yay. So thank you very much for supporting the show. It's very much appreciated. Have yourself a good week. Stay safe. If you're eating any cake, let me know about it, because I haven't eaten any cake in over 2 weeks, and I would love to have some cake at the moment, but I'm not allowed any cake. So there we go. Have yourself a good week, folks. Stay safe and be good. Lots of love. Bye-bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.